Good morning, and it is 10 o'clock here at WCOM LP Chapel Hill Carrboro, 103.5 FM on your radio dial, and you are listening to the Counselor's Cafe. And this is where we focus on the care and feeding of the mind, the psyche, the spirit, whatever it is that makes us human, conscious of self, capable of change, and free to make choices. And wonder if we are free to make choices. And how do we know enough to make a choice? Which is, you know, we are, there's actually a nuclear physicist, not a nuclear physicist, a person who got a Nobel Prize because he did this great study on how human beings make decisions based on insufficient information. Anyway, we do make choices, whether they're based on enough information or not. This morning, we invite you to join in on a continuing conversation we're having with Paul Nage and other visitors as they come in that is dealing about with the nature of existence. Paul is host of Touchstones here at WCOM at Tuesdays at 11 a.m., and he discusses the nature of spiritual experience. Today, we'll be discussing what is happiness, how to find it, do we recognize it, are we entitled to it? Will we know it if we stumbled over it? Join in the discussion with any questions or comments you may have by calling 929-9601. This is meant to be an open conversation with anybody out there who wants to join in. If you can't call right now, you can always get in touch later by emailing counselorscafe@nc.rr.com or by writing to Counselor Box 6, 200 West Weaver Street, Carrboro, North Carolina, and let me know what it is you'd like to talk about or you'd like us to talk about. And while I'm talking about getting in touch, check out WCOM's website at www.communityradio.coop. Take our listener survey, click on the program pages, explore the site, find out what your community radio station is, and try to give us some kind of feedback by taking the survey. Okay, Paul is with us this morning, and we're going to take a very short break, just a few minutes of Horace Staccato with Ruggiero Ricci, just to wild, wonderful violinist, just to wake us up a little and get us going talking about happiness. Okay. Okay, a little bit of Horace Staccato played by Ruggiero Ricci on that absolutely fantastic violin to get us going, talking about happiness. And hey, Paul, are you happy?
Well, you know what they say, happiness is a good cup of coffee in the morning. And I did have my cup of coffee, but it may not have been good enough.
Well, it, you know, and going through some of the little notes I had taken, I think it was Schweitzer that says, no, it was, he said nothing more than health and a poor memory. But there was someone who said that happiness basically is a good breakfast. So if you had a good cup of coffee, that consisted of good breakfast.
Yeah, right. Well, I haven't had my good breakfast. That was Samuel Johnson. Oh, he was the one who said there's happiness is produced by a good inn or tavern.
Right.
Yeah.
John Gunther, the author, John Gunther, all happiness depends on a leisurely breakfast.
Yeah.
Well, you know, in a way, I would get a little, not that all happiness depends on that, but after many years of jumping out of bed in the morning to take care of 7 kids, when it finally got to the point where I didn't have to do that, when I could not just, I don't eat breakfast normally, but have a leisurely cup of coffee, that was pleasurable to a large extent. I don't know if we want to say that pleasure is happiness?
Well, some people think it is. It's definitely the thoughtless person's guide to happiness is whatever feels good at the moment. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's only when you figure out that what felt good at the moment wasn't necessarily good in the long run, like eating the whole bag of cookies. was fun at the time, but gave me a tummy ache.
So we need to balance happiness with a little recognition of consequences.
Yeah.
Of what follows.
I think it's a generalized sense of pleasure. It's putting mm-hmm. pleasure in a larger framework. Is where we get this idea that happiness is some kind of goal in life. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the person that's most faulted for this, who set this up as a condition, was Aristotle.
Uh-huh.
In other words, happiness is somewhat of a selfish goal when you think mm-hmm. about it. I mean, and in most of the world's philosophy, happiness is not the summum bonum. It's not the big thing to go after. It's not the big bone. Yeah.
Well, again, it defines is it a subjective thing?
No, I'm talking about, you know, when you're born into a family and mm-hmm. you live your life on this earth, happiness is something that is not necessarily a main motive for how you set your life up.
So it's more responsibility to the group, perhaps?
Responsibility to the family, to the group. To survival, so forth and so on.
So then could you consider that happiness, I mean, because you're putting a particular meaning on happiness there. Happiness could not possibly be the satisfaction one gets from living up to your values, and your values being the well-being of the whole?
Well, yeah, but that's that's putting it sort of backwards. Uh-huh. Because if we start that the thoughtless view of happiness, mm-hmm. that where we get the idea of happiness is in pleasure, mm-hmm. and it's exercise, the exercise of pleasure, and then happiness is a reflection on the exercise of pleasure. In other words, you recognize that pleasure has its consequences. And that pleasure needs to be contextualized in a variety of ways, that there are pleasures that are pleasurable and then there are pleasures that ultimately are destructive, and how to exercise pleasures pleasurably without being unpleasured in the long run is where the idea of happiness starts to arise.
Got me a little lost there, Paul.
Too many pleasures
too
for
many
you.
Too many pleasures. Maybe I'm happy.
Yeah, right. You know, but that's only if we go by this sort of reductive definition of happiness as the exercise of pleasure.
Right.
And pleasure as belonging to one's, you know, self, one's personal self, as opposed to the group self. But, you know, what we know about, you know, how people evolve, and you know, there are lots of people. One of my arguments, for instance, in the fundamentalist Latter-day Saint group, in which you have the group marriages with all the young multiple brides, is that many of these people's personalities develop in such a way that they are very oriented towards the group good.
Well, there are cultures so like that, too.
Well, it is, yeah. Right. And so they're so oriented to the group good that they don't have a strong sense of independent self. And that's maybe historically may have been the norm for most human beings in their lives.
Not having the sense of self, just having more of a sense of growth.
Not having a sense of independent self from the group, from the family, from the survival unit that they belong to. So they have a stronger sense of belonging. And when they're taken out of that context, there's a lot of confusion, depression, despair, alarm, anxiety, and so forth and so on. In fact, one of the reasons why I think, you know, Heidegger, that existentialist philosopher, thought of anxiety as being is that individualism grows out of anxiety, out of the anxiety of being rooted out of your primordial group. So where you have connections with others that are, you know.
The feeling of isolation that you might get from being feeling separate.
Yeah, but also the sense of danger, fright and flight, you know, the amygdala response, as one of my guests recently put it.
Well, you've got the whole idea then of, because what I'm thinking, okay, the value of the group, the need to belong, the need to feeling accepted, and then you get that, what was it, Jim Jones? And
the suicide
the
group?
The Kool-Aid group.
Yeah.
Well, but when do you get to the point where you no longer are a self-motivated individual?
Well, there's relatively good evidence.
Yeah.
Since I've talked to the few survivors of that issue, is that more than half those people were coerced into drinking that Kool-Aid.
But they went down there to begin with because they needed a leader.
They went down there because they believed in what the leader was saying in terms of their values. They had very progressive sort of socialist values. And of course, and you know, they were, you know, they were non-consumerist. They had a non-consumerist view of they had interracial harmony was one of their their values. Personally, they had a lot of noble values, and they had a psychotic leader that that took over.
Right.
But his psychosis grew, and like the classic thing of the frog in the vat of boiling water, it grew in increments so that most of the frogs that were in the water, you know, noticed it was going wrong, but noticed it in such slow increments that a lot of them didn't bail. The people bailed out of that group.
Right.
But most people, by the time, had, you know, they had their commitments. Their commitments were in there, and it became more and more difficult for them to bail, even though they knew this guy was nuts.
Well, that's you know, anyway, we're talking about happiness and
we're talking about Jimmy Jones.
But I mean,
Well, was
whether
he happy?
Or not is your feeling of having to be part of a group, and whether it's the happiness of the group that gives you the satisfaction, or it is the search for individual meaning.
But that's so Western American, you know, that's presuming the individual, the isolated individual.
But how, I mean, of course, our Western grouping came out of, you know, European still being Western, but people fleeing conditions where they could not achieve any sort of group security.
Well, partly because their own values were in conflict with the dominant values of the society, and the society that had the dominant values felt that it was perfectly justified to coerce people to accept the dominant values. If you didn't accept these dominant values, then you were deserving of punishment, oppression, and other forms of censure.
Right.
And that's so people were escaping that form of censure, you know. I mean,
so
you know,
are we going to define happiness then as, I mean, are as the idea that we belong to a group where we are accepted?
That's one of the issues, because you can say that what I think is the foregone conclusion, because the way we're raised, you know, we're infants and we can't raise ourselves, you know.
Mm-hmm.
If we're at 6 months of age and we're thrown out of an airplane into the forest, we're likely to become somebody's, food.
Yes, yes.
Rather than be raised by the wolves.
Right.
You know, and if we were raised by the wolves, we're going to think like wolves, and we're going to think, you know, in a pack mentality.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know. We're not going to think like human beings,
right.
And we're probably never going to learn how to talk. So, in other words, what I'm saying is that this group orientation is deeply formative of who we are and what we want to be. Well, we got to have another person joining us here. This is the host of the Saturday morning. What's the name of your show, Rocco?
Music Hall, Paul.
The Music Hall, right?
How could you forget?
And that's right. It's that weird stuff that people play to make themselves happy. We're discussing happiness, Rocco, and I'm discussing that happiness is. It's merely an extension of the idea of pleasure. In other words, it's the reflective view of pleasure. But ultimately, the idea that happiness should be a goal in life is pleasurable, and it's an extension of pleasure. Obviously, it's thoughtful pleasure, because you realize that you can't that all pleasures aren't necessarily without consequence, and sometimes the consequence of pleasures is unpleasurable. So you have to learn how to be pleasure your pleasures in such a way that you're not over-pleasured.
Well, you know,
or under-pleasured.
Do you follow that?
I think Paul needs to be on television.
Well, you can see you'll see how I tend to pleasure myself overly with food. Yes.
Well, how do we get from there into Maslow's
hierarchy of human needs?
Of human
yes.
needs
yeah,
and self-actualization.
Point. Okay. Uh-huh. Yeah, that's a good question. Why don't you tell
achieving,
me?
Yes, as achieving happiness through exploring your own greatest possibilities.
So, in the hierarchy of human needs, mm-hmm. where would you put that group impulse that I've been emphasizing so much? The necessity.
I don't know that they were like six or seven levels, and I don't remember
where. What are the lower ones?
It was like the third or fourth. The need for interaction, which is a need, we do have that. So, is happiness perhaps stage connected?
I'm sure it is, in terms, particularly in the reflectiveness of it, you know.
So that your development.
I believe it was a pyramid.
Was it a pyramid?
And
it could
the
be.
Base was larger than the, right. the peak, the top of the pyramid.
So self-actualization was merely this little eye on top of the pyramid.
Exactly.
Right. Whereas the survival needs of of warmth, health, security,
mm-hmm.
and basic security needs are the needs that I'm saying are the formative ones
mm-hmm.
that may or may not make happiness a goal.
And it, right.
You know. And it,
but he was saying once you achieved a certain level, you were able to move up, but your need for that diminished somewhat.
Yeah, what was it? There was a sort of need levels and then being
mm-hmm.
levels.
Mm-hmm.
And so deficiency levels. Mm-hmm. They have a sense of deficiency at a certain
mm-hmm.
point.
Mm-hmm.
And then once you have a sense of sufficiency, a degree of sufficiency right. at these certain levels, then you can go on to the being levels.
Mm-hmm. It's like if you have a craving for candy and then you live for 2 years in a candy store, you can pretty well lose that need or desire for candy for the rest of your life.
If you eat too much of it. Yeah, that's true.
Right. Mm-hmm. So you when the need becomes well satisfied, then it sort of recedes to some degree.
Yeah. And this is where Aristotle, who again is the one we blame for mm-hmm. happiness being set up as the sunum bonum, and by that, and following Maslow, it would mean that it's being needs we're talking about now. So we're making a distinction between survival needs, mm-hmm. Which deal with sufficiency and insufficiency, mm-hmm. and which we argue that there is some degree of sufficiency is necessary. We have to have some sense of safety, mm-hmm. some sense of security. What are some of the others?
But then you have somebody who's got $20 million or $1 billion,
and it feels
miserable.
They feel a feeling of profound lack, that they don't
life
have
has
enough.
No meaning.
Have the,
what do you think, Rocco?
Well, you know, with Maslow was from the University of Chicago, wasn't
uh-huh.
he? Herbert Maslow?
I think so, yeah.
Right,
yeah.
He was from Chicago. So I imagine he was a Midwestern mm-hmm. young fella growing up in the Midwest, and I think that shaped his ideas.
It gets cold in the winter, so you got to have you don't have
right. his ideas about food, shelter, and clothing.
Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly.
Right.
Rather than someone living in a penthouse apartment in Manhattan,
mm-hmm.
you know, they're going to be coming from a different
because
different
those
angle.
Needs are have already been met sufficiently and are assumed.
That's right.
I had a professor once who said that someone who's digging in the ground for roots to eat isn't thinking about the PTA.
That's right.
You know, you have survival is
right.
the first need. And maybe sex or continuation of the species
Maslow,
is the next.
Wasn't he very, very popular maybe in the 50s, 60s, 70s?
Mm-hmm.
And his star was rising, I mm-hmm. think, in graduate school classes. And mm-hmm. they were, you know, reading his work to business people who mm-hmm. were going to deal with a lot of people and educators. And I don't know if his star is still as high as it is. I've been away from graduate
mm-hmm.
school
yes.
for quite a while.
Well,
it's like everything else. It gets built on and incorporated.
But aren't there new people that have come along and have changed some ideas about things?
Well, one of the big people or the upcoming and talked about people is Martin Seligman, who's really come up with the notion of positive psychology.
Okay.
So basically putting forth the idea that psychology and psychiatry needs to be not only concentrating on relieving the pain of mental health problems and bringing you to a sort of a stasis where you are nowhere, but to have the disciplines concentrating on building on strengths to get to a point where you are actively, perhaps, happy. It's positive psychology.
Well, that's sort of stressing the strengths that you
right,
have
right.
and reinforcing them. You get a little bit of B.F. Skinner and
mm-hmm.
Other people
right.
in that psychology field that were putting that out years
mm-hmm.
ago,
mm-hmm.
really. And, you know, in the schools with the kids, a lot of times students need to stress their strengths.
Mm-hmm.
If someone's not good in geometry and never will be good in geometry, you don't keep forcing geometry on them, making them try to excel.
Isn't that statement it's not how smart you are, it's how you are smart.
Right.
So that each of us has some degree of smartness in what we do. And they talk about the genius of an athlete. And
stressing the strengths of the athlete, just
exactly.
like playing the guitar.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if you guys can play the guitar. I can't play the guitar.
I play at the guitar.
But we've had some people here at this station in the studio, and they are very, very skilled and talented
uh-huh.
playing the guitar
right.
and other instruments. And you know,
it's hard to get the harpsichord players in here. That's true.
That's true. But yeah, stressing the strengths of people,
right?
I think is very, very important.
So,
but you know, the thing, the very discovery of things. I think what I'm emphasizing is overemphasizing maybe is individualism. One of the areas that we are faulted, and I think actually the reason why is our basic thing of our consumerism,
mm-hmm.
which is in terms of our own style, we have two styles that are very dominant in our popular culture now. Mm-hmm. One is consumerist style, which mm-hmm. is that I exercise my tastes, varieties, and my satisfaction. In other words, I seek some kind of pleasure, some kind of happiness from going out and making a purchase.
Getting the next biggest best thing.
Yeah, whatever it is. Yeah, but, you know, it's whatever, you know, what, you know, for me, it's, you know, getting in my next comic book of, mm-hmm. You know, Madame Xanadu or something.
Mm-hmm.
But the, you know, I have very modest needs.
Freedom has been described as the ability to go into a store and buy anything you want. That's freedom.
But the freedom is conditional upon you having the money in your pocket to do it.
Exactly.
Otherwise, your freedom is going in and stealing whatever you want. Yes,
you get arrested.
And then your freedom is taken away.
So we do have this, that deals with a being need versus the sufficiency need.
Right.
The sufficiency is you have enough money in your pocket. Well, we're actually, so we have this consumerist value,
mm-hmm.
and we have the underlying lie of happiness being based on that.
Mm-hmm.
That somehow, you know, the acquisition of goods and or services or experiences. Mm-hmm. And that means that part of the consumerist model is all the weird, mindless travel we do,
mm-hmm.
including, I would say, being somewhat critical of these things, that the spiritual consumerism that I see with people going into Ecuador and getting a shamanic experience, mm-hmm. where they get covered with mud or something and spit at by the local shaman, and they consider this a great initiation.
Yes.
Well, it's amazing what people will put up with, you know, for experiences, you know. But the
you know, if it works for them.
Well, don't.
But
you think...
see, that's the problem. Let's look at that. You see, there's an underlying conceit there that I think needs to be looked at rigorously. I'm not against happiness per se,
right.
But I think it needs to be put in a certain context.
Wouldn't you say that there are many, many people out there, the three of us included, that do things that we do them because we think we have to do them or should do them,
mm-hmm.
but really don't want to do them? And
you mean like get out of bed in the morning?
Well, a lot of people will work at a job, do this, try to move up the ladder.
Right.
Because they think they have to.
Right.
Or they need to.
That's the definitions of the game you're playing at this work.
Mm-hmm.
This work says that you compete with each other so that you can succeed in certain ways.
Right. They value success by moving up. They really don't want to be the boss or be
right.
the whatever. But they feel like they need to. If they don't, then they're...
And they don't define what success means to them.
That's right.
So they are... kind of accepting what they've been socialized into without questioning, or questioning to the point where they feel they can make choices. And that is one of the biggest points or definitions, I think, of coming to a full realization of being a human being, is understanding that you do have choice. In the ultimate, you choose your attitude, if nothing else. There have been times.
Right. Like what you said in yourself, and other times you found yourself a widow and you had all mm-hmm. these kids to raise.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now.
I had the choice.
You
I
had a choice.
Out.
You had a choice. You could say, well, let somebody else take care of these mm-hmm. kids, or you say, I've got to take care of these kids.
But
and
I've got
I'm
to.
Do
I
it.
Want to. This is what is yeah. making me happy.
I remember the psychologist. Piaget?
Yes, yes.
He was another one with B.F. Skinner and Maslow and Pavlov.
They had a lot of, yeah, that's true, but these guys thought very different types of thoughts. So,
all right,
so
how what about would you, Piaget? How would you define Piaget's ideas about what we're talking about? He was very popular at one time, and I don't know if he still is. I know he's in the textbooks.
Well, he's very much into, I mean, he was working with infants and children, and
But what he did is he's actually in some ways one of the founders of what became much more dominant after we left graduate school, which was cognitive psychology. He was sort of the father of cognitive psychology. Now, he discovered sensory and cognitive modes in infancy and the development of these things, and he did it, you know, in a clinical experimental way that was reproducible. You know, the classic one being that at a certain age, a baby can see depth and can fear falling. I forget, the 4 months or something. But about the time they start crawling around, they can know they could fall off the cliff, you know. So, and that's a good survival need, you know. Before that, they don't know about falling off the cliff and often do. But the
wasn't he also the one who talked about the expansion of a person's realm, or you could say worldview, so that the infant immediately is only going to see the person that provides nutrition. Is generally the mother, and then as they grow a little bit more, they're able to see their world as maybe including a few other people.
Yeah, like the father or the siblings.
You get to a point where you see the world as your backyard, your street, your neighborhood.
Well, that's why.
But I think he was more interested in cognitive things, such as, at a certain level. You know, I realize that the quantity of a volume doesn't change just because the bottle is taller. Right. At a certain age, a child will see the same amount of water being poured into a larger bottle, and you say, which one is more? Mm-hmm. And the child will say, the bigger bottle is more. Mm-hmm. The question's wrong, and the slightly older child is going to say, no, they're the same. Mm-hmm. See, so what he was able to do was to suddenly show that these were developmental sequences and a cognitive development that took place in general stages, and some of those distinctions were quote never noticed before, and that's his brilliance and his genius of what he did. However,
What do we do about happiness in a world and a society today
in which we think that
depression is one of the largest and most costly in terms of both human and economic?
Well, it seems like now they're trying to do chemical therapy, pills, medicine.
Yes,
but that's prescription. That's an underlying issue of the consumerism, though. Mm-hmm. I also wanted I think connected in an insidious way to consumerism is also our cult of celebrity. Mm-hmm. That instead of having heroes that represent norms of value and moral excellence, what we have now is people who are just known, and that the only thing they have to recommend them is their being known.
Oh, you know,
the classic it girl.
Like Kapoor.
That maybe started in the 20s or the early part of the last century. Yeah.
When our consumerist society starts.
Well, if you get into mass media and the mass selling of stuff. I mean.
Well, in this country, youth and beauty. Mm-hmm. Athleticism sells. Mm-hmm. If you're a great athlete, if you're handsome, if you're beautiful, if you're an actor, actress.
This again is, you know, so if you are handsome, therefore you are desirable, therefore you have a quality which is purely accidental, that somebody thinks you're handsome. or that a great many people think you're handsome or beautiful. And the point being is that, but ultimately, you don't do anything to achieve it or to, though you may benefit from it. The question is that that may lead to, you're getting some of your sufficiency needs met mm-hmm. in an easy way where there's no struggle or striving or less struggle and striving. But it doesn't lead to happiness.
Right. Because so happiness then being something that would come up from inside.
Well, even the sense of pleasure, the need for pleasure, the need to, scratch an itch, requires some kind of agency on ourselves that we're going to exercise it.
I have a good question for both of you.
Yeah. Okay.
I do.
All right.
Uh-oh. If you have a child from birth to, say, age 5 or 6 that is unhappy, never has been happy during those formative years, do you think they will ever be able to overcome that and later on in life become a balanced, well-rounded person and be able to be happy in life?
I think
only in a depressive fashion.
I think it is possible, but it would take an awful amount of work on both that individual and on the part of someone who was willing to help them recondition the way they view the world.
So they would have a lot to overcome.
A lot to overcome.
Well, there's an interesting point here that came up with some of the notes that you suggested that we look at here. And one of the findings, I'm going to actually just sort of read this. One of the findings of happiness research, which is part of what we're supposedly discussing here, though we really haven't got to it yet, they have sacrificed some of our sacred cows by disproving long-held beliefs. And this is one that's, for example, we now know that positive feelings like happiness and joy are somewhat independent of negative feelings like depression and anxiety. So just because you don't feel bad doesn't mean you feel good. The same way, just because you feel bad does not mean you don't feel some sense of good. They are separate tracks. It's sort of like, they're like separate records going on in your head. I'm so miserable. It's going on one side of the brain. And I'm pretty happy. I'm having a good old time here. Going on the other side. I'm so miserable. I'm very happy. This is going on at the same time. And, one may be louder than the other.
There's an old saying that goes, the thought you feed is the thought that grows. And what thoughts you concentrate on, you focus on, what grabs your attention is what's going to eventually drown out the other thoughts.
But let's take it. Let's take that I've trained myself to listen to, I'm a kind of happy guy. Happy guy, and then somebody comes along and gives me a slight, and all of a sudden I'm a kind of happy guy goes whoop, and then all of a sudden I got that other song singing there that I haven't been paying attention to. I'm really a miserable dog. Rocco, you tend to be of all the people I know, you are almost emblematic for me of someone who has a really right view attitude towards things. I mean, it's an upbeat attitude towards the world, towards yourself, towards everybody, and you extend this. You're gracious. You look at people and you see their best, and
strengths that they have.
Yeah, and even when they're not there, and I think this is really, really quite commendable. And do you see having these two tapes playing in your own head?
Let's take the two of you. I remember when you came to the station, and you were a little bit interested, Paul. I had to kind of coerce to come here. I knew he would be great with radio, and he is. You can just hear him and listen to him and how he's on this show right now with you. And you had to remember with the radio deal, I had a lot of experience in radio. I worked at 10 different radio stations in the 60s, and had years of experience with it and knew what sounded good and what didn't, and what is good radio and what is not. Mm-hmm. You know, just like a movie.
Right.
A movie is either good or it's not good. If somebody goes to the movies and they say it's a good movie, well, mm-hmm. that means it's pretty good. I mean, they enjoyed it. It might not be the greatest movie in the world, but it's a good movie.
And it's a good movie in their opinion.
Well, and first with you, Audrey, mm-hmm. when you came here and you found yourself on the air
yes.
with Chris.
Yes.
Chris was our station manager,
right.
and he
right.
gave you the opportunity to be on the right. air. And I was right here saying, Audrey, uh-huh. you need to go on the air.
Uh-huh.
Because I had talked with you,
right.
and I knew how smart you were and how intellectually astute you are and how you had a desire to go on. You were a little bit timid, but all you needed was that little push,
uh-huh.
and I was trying to help you and help the station. We needed people
mm-hmm.
that were dedicated, conscientious, mm-hmm. and willing to take on a show. And you fit the bill.
Well, you talk about challenges. I mean, I can still remember the first time sitting in front of this board and saying on the air, okay, I feel like I've been given a jet plane to play.
You're in the cockpit
to fly,
now. You're flying.
And I notice nobody here is listening to me now because none of these buttons are, none of those dials are moving at all.
Well, I knew it would just be a matter of time before you would fit in. I used to be a station manager at a station. So I had a little experience uh-huh. that maybe you didn't have with
right.
radio,
right.
only radio.
Right.
And all you needed was the chance.
But then again, and here we get going back to something like happiness. And I'm going to talk about people who perhaps have reached a point in their lives where they can't find a purpose for themselves. The children are grown. They've peaked in their career and they're looking at retirement, or they are retired and they don't know what to do with themselves because the world is not giving them a task. They have to go
right.
within themselves to
feel like they're
their
not
own
needed.
Meaning. Exactly.
Yeah.
And it's being that the sense of meaning and purpose is at the core of human happiness.
With Paul, let me just finish this. With Paul, I had known Paul for a few years mm-hmm. and knew what he was capable of and knew he would be dynamite on the radio.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I put you two
right,
together.
Right.
And I said, Audrey, you need to meet this fellow. Paul, we need to get him on the air here
uh-huh.
at the station because he will bring a wealth
right.
of intellectual knowledge. He has a great voice.
Mm-hmm.
He's experienced. He knows a ton of stuff.
And he
about,
can talk up a storm.
About everything.
I could cook up a storm, you said.
And, talk up a storm.
yeah, right.
And we need people at this station
uh-huh, yes.
like that.
Yes.
And I said, Paul, this station
and
is
where
a
I
family.
Wasn't really quite as good in the salon factor because other people wanted to talk occasionally.
Uh-huh.
Right.
Which I found annoying.
If you noticed yesterday,
interfering with your happiness.
we had our little get together over at the
right.
brewery. I was more concerned with taking some of the folks or the people that I have met here and mm-hmm. know at the station and introducing them to other people
mm-hmm.
because I knew you didn't know each other. And I was trying to introduce,
yeah.
for example, Paul to this person and that
right.
person and that person. And
that's one of the things of the get together. One of the main purposes is because we're all in on different times. We come in, we go out. We don't have much of a chance to meet each other
mm-hmm.
As a large group, unless we're on a committee.
Exactly.
And that again is building a sense of cohesiveness and belonging.
The station is a family.
Right.
It really is. And
so it can provide happiness.
We
in that
tried
exchange.
To. You know, we're trying to support each other.
It is amazing how completely different all many of our personalities are. I beyond what Rocco, the people that Rocco introduced me to, I went over and chatted up a few
mm-hmm.
DJs that I didn't know. And, you know, there's an incredible amount of talent base. I mean, it's very oriented towards music for some reason,
mm-hmm.
Which, you know, I find, as I said, I've you know, neurologically impaired when it comes to music. You know, it just sort of leaves me flat, you know. It's one of the reasons why, for instance, you know, somebody told me I should always have a little musical interlude in my show. And I thought, uh-huh. yeah, you know, who needs music? You know,
we all need.
Well, see, we're free here to do a number of things that we could not do if we were commercial. If we were a commercial station, it would be a different world, and we'd kind of be locked in the studio. We'd have to do the spots, the commercials, the IDs.
Right.
You know, we don't want any mistakes. We don't want this or that, or you're going to lose business.
Right.
And if
you lose business,
you're going to be
our
off the
business
air.
Is the community. So, let's get back to happiness. And how would you suggest that people find happiness?
Yeah, see, now one of the things you did is you adroitly avoided my question, Rocco.
My question was that
you've got an upbeat tape going, you know. And it's an upbeat tape about other people and probably a relatively upbeat tape about yourself, at least your limitations.
Here's where that's coming from.
So do you have a downbeat tape going?
I don't know. But
you ain't listening to it.
Where's the upbeat tape coming from?
It's coming from working with the schools for 40 years.
Uh-huh.
In that I've realized that you have to stress the strengths of people For example, broken homes means mm-hmm. broken kids.
Mm-hmm.
It really
does. It does, yeah.
When you have a broken home, mm-hmm. the kids
are stressed.
Yeah, they get mm-hmm. stressed, and they stay stressed. Mm-hmm. If you want to maybe solve a lot of problems, have happy families, have people come together, mm-hmm. get married, have children, have a family, and stay together, and do the best they can, I guess. And I think you'd see a lot of our problems in the society melt away. Where I think it comes from with me.
Your interest in giving. Because that's what you're doing. You're giving to the kids because you perceive the need that they need to connect with someone who sees them as worthwhile.
Maybe that's it. Mm-hmm. And kids are hard to help.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how do you help a teenager? It is not easy to help a teenager.
Right.
You know, at that age, they're at a rebellious age in their life, and they don't like things that you tell them they need to know or that they should know. So it's sort of a balancing act. And with people, I don't try to hurt anybody or take anything from anybody.
No, I never have. You're always giving. And one of the things that brings up, and I'm not going to be sure which psychologist aimed at this particular, it might have been Glasser, who said that an absolute requirement of happiness for each individual is to know there is at least one other person on the planet who cares about whether he lives or dies.
You know, that's one of the studies, one of the universal results of the studies about happiness studies is closely tied to how we think about our lives,
mm-hmm.
especially life satisfaction or the gap we perceive between what we have and what we want out of life, and that overall happiness is best predicted by a satisfaction in the specific areas of love relationships, self-esteem, standard of living, and friendship areas.
Mm-hmm.
So, though as much as, you know, that somebody cares, which is the love relationship,
mm-hmm.
also other people can easily substitute, I have enough money in the bank,
mm-hmm.
and I have a dog, you know. So the dog cares about
Well, the
me.
Dog will do, you know, a pet will really solve that. Money in the bank is not going to.
It gives me the money to afford to have the dog so that somebody cares about me.
You can get a dog from the pound and all you have to do is get up some scraps.
Yeah, but it is true, though. I mean, the capacity for caring that a pet has. Of course,
uh-huh.
I don't have pets. I just have books.
Uh-huh.
And what's nice about them is they don't require a lot of feeding or walking.
That's what a friend of mine said about plants. The nice thing about plants was if they died, you just throw it out and get another one.
Yeah, yeah. But there is this capacity for care, this mm-hmm. this nurturance.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, plants require, they require water.
Right.
They require some attention.
Right. It's not like
And dogs and cats require even more attention because
mm-hmm.
not only do they need to be watered and fed, but they also have to be cleaned up after and
right.
probably occasionally petted, you know. or something like that.
So you find, Bill, that could you say that through the books you feel like you're connecting with other human beings? Through the whatever is going on in the book.
Yeah, I probably have developed in myself a personality that is more interested in, you know, what goes on in my own head than mm-hmm. I'm interested in. And I'm interested in what goes on other people's heads. Mm-hmm. But most people aren't used to that. They're more interested in, you know, what goes on between us. Mm-hmm. And for whatever reasons, my profound neglect as a child or whatever, I have a sort of interior fault. And, you know, it's what it is. I mean, you know, I've survived this long.
I want to throw in here, if people are feeling that they have more of a negative tape going in their heads than a positive tape, one of the things to look at is being aware of what you're saying to yourself. And you can do this simply by writing down. When you start having thoughts, just write them down. This is what I'm saying. And changing those. On the opposite side, if you're hearing yourself say, I can never find the right person to be with. It's never going to happen. I'll always be alone. I'm always going to be miserable. Then actually physically write down next to that on a piece of paper, I will find a friend. I will find people to connect with. And when you hear yourself saying the negative things, you can say something else instead.
Yeah,
so one of the things that
the changing of the script I think is a really important thing.
Very important.
Like for years I used to say, you know, one day I'm going to find the right person that mm-hmm. we're going to want to live to one another. Mm-hmm. So after 40 years of not finding that person, I finally say, you know, someday I'm not going to find the person that I'm going to live with, and I'm perfectly happy now.
Yes. See, now that leads us up to five paths to happiness. That also mm-hmm. came out of one of the things we took our notes from is the quality of life therapy, which is part of this new positive psychology.
Mm-hmm.
One is change your circumstances. So if you're miserable in your job, or if you're miserable because you're living in Arizona and there's no trees and it's hot all the time, look at the possibilities.
Move to North Carolina, where there's
lots of trees and humidity,
and it's hot some of the time. Yeah.
But change your circumstances. It can be a job. It can be the way if you're involved with a group of people you dislike, then just change that. Go with somebody else. Or if you can't change your circumstances, if you can't move, change your attitude. And this is the choices we always have. All right, this situation is miserable, but I can, bring down my dissatisfaction with that by focusing more on what is positive in my life. So you change your attitude towards it. You can change your goals and standards. It can be, say, I wanted to be an opera singer. I love opera. I will never be an opera singer. So instead, have as my goal, I'm going to work on a stage and be a handy person, put up the,
right.
the drapes
stage
or something.
Hand. Stage manager. Hand.
I'm going to be a faithful member of the audience of opera singers.
Yes, and be able to, soak it in.
I'm going to support up-and-coming opera singers.
Mm-hmm. You can change your priorities. So what is the most important thing in your life? And this I think we all need to do. When we were talking before about people saying they have to follow this particular road to success by going up this corporate ladder, perhaps, to really examine that, what it is you think that is going to give to you, and begin to understand that you can find it perhaps in other ways, find those values in ways that are not so inimical to your spirit, and then boost your satisfaction in other areas.
Well,
as part of the whole
thing. I think most of us, we get what we want. If you mm-hmm. want something, and if you're persistent, you don't give up. If you try and stay with it, you pretty much get what you want.
But be careful of what you ask for; you just might get it.
Yeah, there is a presumption here, and the presumption is that what we think we know, the way we think we want to change our conditions, will maximize our happiness And two, that changing somehow, either our circumstances or ourselves in varying degrees, in varying ways, has something to do with our happiness.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of the great philosophical views really said that that wasn't true.
Mm-hmm.
And it was it's the Stoic position. Fortune, which is what happens to you that's outside of your mm-hmm. circumstances, and this may include your circumstance.
Mm-hmm.
If you're born into slavery, and unfortunately there are more slaves in the world today than there was back when we had our Civil War,
mm-hmm.
it may not be relatively possible for you to change your circumstance without
right.
imperiling your life, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or your ability, you know, or other.
So it's what you do with your circumstance.
So it's what you, yeah, it's mm-hmm. what you, it's what you, it's not what you do with your circumstances, because you may not be able to change your circumstances.
Not changing the circumstances, but how you act within that set of circumstances.
If you're given lemons, make lemonade.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, mm-hmm. and that, but knowing the difference between what you can do and what you can't do may
right.
be the real key to change. In other
mm-hmm.
words, there are certain things you may not be able to change. Up until a few years ago, many of us could not change our gender.
Right.
Until science came along and decided, yes, if you really feel like you're a woman in a man's body, well, we can make you at least cosmetically congruent with that inner vision.
I want to offer for everybody who would be interested in following up on this to read Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning, because that is comes to the ultimate of what your attitude is and your perception of having meaning in your life.
And actually,
is your survival technique.
And Frankl is congruent with the Stoical view that I was
mm-hmm.
talking about. Though I would say that he's more than that too.
He's more than that. And Stoic yeah. makes you think that you're standing there and you're taking
putting
all the slings and arrows, and it doesn't sound like a very happy, but it's a circumstance to be in. But it goes beyond that.
A way that I will expand occasionally on things. So I'll be reading them and also talking about what's being said. So it'll be
okay.
going in and out of the sermon.
Let us cut on out of here, because Tobin Logan is in the other room waiting to come in for readings with Tobin. Thanks for being with us, people, and come back again next week for the Counselor's Cafe.